Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, I'm Chad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. Today, kind of a hard topic to describe. We're calling it animal minds. Animal minds.
Or maybe the better way to say it is minds other than our own.
Which would be the animals, no?
That's the animals.
Well, we're animals, though. Yeah, you're right.
So we live with, I mean, we're having enough trouble just talking to each other. But imagine if you were a Labrador.
That'd be tough.
See, then we'd have a problem, or a whale.
No, maybe we wouldn't. That's kind of what we're looking at. How much can you really share with, you know, a Labrador or a whale?
Right. And we're not solving this problem in this show at all.
No.
But
no.
Maybe we could do this. Maybe instead of talking to scientists about other minds, maybe we should talk to...
a writer?
Yeah.
Paul, can you hear me? Paul, can you hear? Paul.
The writer we chose to look for, you may now know, was named Paul.
Okay, stand by.
Paul Theroux.
I'm not hearing anything.
He's the author of any number of travel books, novels.
Didn't he win a big prize?
I'm sure.
Yes. Is that Jad?
Yes. Hi.
J-A-D?
That's me. Like a Pulitzer or one of the big ones.
Okay.
No, he didn't win a Pulitzer, but he won a prize of my heart when he wrote The Patagonia Express.
Oh, so you're taping. Okay, great.
Yes, yep. Yes. Anyhow, Paul Theroux travels all around the world writing about all kinds of things. But the reason we called him is for something that actually happened in his backyard.
Which, luckily for him, happens to be in the state of Hawaii.
I own 7 acres on a slope. A west-facing slope on the north shore of Oahu.
Oh.
And I had very, very long grass. And someone said, oh, I know what you need is some geese. They'll take care of that grass. So I got a couple.
And you decided not to go to the hardware store and buy a lawnmower. You decided to buy 2 animate birds.
That's right. I would have needed a really, really serious industrial mower. Instead, I get 2 non-industrial geese. Oh, I actually got 3. 2 ganders and a goose. And a strange thing happened. One of the ganders imprinted on me.
So what does that mean?
So it means the baby chick boy looked at you.
Yes.
and
the first moving thing they see is the mother figure. This goose became very attached, very protective. It would sit my lap. When another goose came up, it would peck at them. Anyway, it was both protective and attentive.
But as the gander grew up, strange things began to happen.
First, it became detached from me, then aggressive toward me, and then needed me. It was very strange, and it made me think, I want to get some more geese, and I want to read more about them, and then watch them.
So he asked friends, and friends said to him, look, if you want to know everything that's important to know about geese, you have to read E.B. White.
Most people mention E.B. White when they talk about geese. And, of course, I know and love E.B. White.
And if you're not a Martian, you probably love E.B. White, too.
What do you mean? I mean,
how many people have read Stuart Little, or how many people have read Charlotte's Web?
Yes, true.
And if you don't love the children's fiction, then he's certainly one of the greatest of all American essayists.
Yeah, see, that's the point. He is one of the great American writers. He actually wrote the Bible for writing.
The Elements of Style.
The Elements of Style. Which
Strunk.
Is still the Bible for writing, weirdly, and it was written like 50 years ago.
So when people point to anything by E.B. White, you point seriously. And in this case, very late in life, after he moved up to a cabin in Maine, he was in his 70s, and this particular essay we're going to talk about is called, very simply,
The Geese.
The Geese, Allen Cove, July 9th, 1971. I have had a pair of elderly gray geese, a goose and a gander, living on this place for a number of years, and they have been my friends.
So Paul Theroux opened the essay,
early in the spring,
fully expecting to learn all about geese. But then he kept running across these little phrases and adjectives that made him cringe.
You know, he talks about a gosling that grows into, I'm quoting now,
a real dandy.
A real dandy.
Full of pompous thoughts and surly gestures.
Pompous thoughts and surly gestures? You know.
But come on, I mean, doesn't that make the goose a little bit more easy to relate to?
All right, take one word. Malice.
I could not tell whether the look in his eye was one of malice or affection.
Malice? Malice is a word you use for, you know, Mussolini or, you know, somebody else. Not for a goose.
But what's the sin in that? If a man who's a professional storyteller and one of the greatest ones says, let me tell you about my geese, and then talks about them as though they were uncles and aunts and neighbors with moods that are distinctly human. So what?
Well, I suppose you could say so. Or you could say, so what if he put them in, you know, little Halloween costumes too, for that matter, so what? But I'm in the writing business. The writing business should be unsparing. He could be quite unsparing himself in his writing. You're giving E.B. White too much license if you're saying it really doesn't matter. It does matter to me.
And the reason it matters, says Paul Theroux, is that E.B. White got so attached to the idea of those geese as aging critters like himself, that he missed something deep and important about the geese.
The elements of that behavior that is pure goose.
Paul pointed to the end of the essay.
Suddenly, I heard sounds of a rumble outside in the barnyard where the ganders were.
Where a formerly great gander gets unseated by a younger male goose. There's a big fight, lots of squawking, and the old gander loses.
I watched as he threaded his way slowly down the narrow path between clumps of thistles and daisies. His head was barely visible above the grasses, but his broken spirit was plain to any eye. I felt very deeply his sorrow and his defeat.
Well, the defeated gander goes off. Well, this isn't true at all. When a gander loses a battle, he goes off, gets his strength back, and waits for a chance to attack again. That gander's going to come back and fight again.
So you're saying that he got it wrong about
yes,
the geese?
Yes, of course. Of course. Here is a man who is solitary. He's a New Yorker who goes to Maine and becomes a gentleman farmer of a kind, and begins to relate to his geese and then writes about them as though he's one of them. I know I'm not one of them.
But if you can't use words that are, you know, very human and psychological words, and if you can't, because you're not a goose, have whatever it is that geese have on their insides, then what if you wanted to share something with a goose? And I bet you do. Is there any way in which you could honestly describe yourself as a friend of any of these geese?
I would say, you know, this is a very good question. I had a very surly, to use an E.B. White word, a very rambunctious gander, and he got very sick. You know, the thing is sitting on the ground, just fouling its nest. I thought he was really going to die. And I nursed him back to health. I gave him antibiotic with a turkey baster. And it took about 3 or 4 weeks. And the first thing he did when he was nursed back to health, he got up on two legs, and I came up with the turkey baster, give him one last drink, and he bit me. And I thought,
Where did he bite you?
He bit my leg hard. And I thought, okay, he's back to health.
You didn't think, ow, how could you?
Well, I thought he's healthy. He's healthy again, and he's behaving just as a goose would.
But don't you see, though, that if the moment of true, of your true, most goosey moment is a moment when you're with the goose that you helped bites you, then you are out of this story, in effect.
I absolutely agree with that. In all of this, there's an implied loneliness. I'm not his friend. I'm not a feathered creature. I'm a human being among birds.
Although, curiously, Paul Theroux does have an approach to communing with his geese. He takes a chair, puts it on the lawn, plops down in the chair, and disappears.
You know, my writing day ends in the early afternoon. I have lunch, and after lunch, there's a long, sunny period in the afternoon when I'm alone, I'm with the geese, and I sit around with them and try to make out what they're doing among each other and paying no particular attention to me. It's simply watching the world as it was. You're seeing creatures who are behaving as though cities don't exist, presidents don't exist, governments don't exist, roads don't exist, as if it's before the fall, as though it's the peaceable kingdom. Simply watching animals who are content doing their thing. Then you feel a bit like Adam.
Radiolab is produced by Chad Abumrad and Soren Wheeler, Michael Raphael, Ellen Horn,
and Lulu Miller, with help from Adi Narayan and Tim Howard.
Special thanks to Brianna Breen and Kelly Carmody. Apologies for butchering any name.
Wait a second. Stop the machine. It just feels weird to end the show this way, with this lonely geese thing. So we're going to play for you one final story. It's kind of a continuation of Paul Theroux and his geese, except it involves a very different guy in a very different climate. First of all, who are you? What's your name?
My name is Paul Nicklin, and I'm a contributing photographer to National Geographic magazine.
Paul Nicklin is basically National Geographic's Arctic guy.
I've been pegged as their polar specialist.
And this particular tale involves his attempt to photograph one of the great Arctic predators.
The leopard seal.
Leopard seal, which by reputation is a very nasty creature.
Preface to this story is, in 2003, tragically, a scientist was actually killed. Kirsty Brown was doing underwater research, and she was taken down by a leopard seal and drowned.
Was she just yanked off the ice? Or?
She was swimming, and it just came up and grabbed her and took her down to 300 feet.
Nonetheless, our story starts with Paul and his guide, Godin. They're in a boat in the Arctic Ocean looking for seals.
The first seal we encountered, I'd never seen a leopard seal before. And we came around into this bay where there was a penguin colony. And right away, Godin, who's seen many, many leopard seals, he said to me, you know, bloody hell, that's the biggest seal I've ever seen. And she came up to the boat with a penguin in her mouth. She went underneath the boat, and she started ramming the penguin underneath the hull of the boat, lifting the bow out of the water. And that's when Godin looks to me, and he says, Paul, it's time for you to get in the water, yeah, in his thick Swedish accent.
Wow. Were you freaking out?
I had dry mouth just from the nervousness. I was trembling, and you know, I put my mask on and slipped over into the 29-degree Fahrenheit water. And there she was, instantly right there. Massive, huge.
Well, how huge?
Probably over 1,000 pounds.
Oh, my God.
12 feet long. She dropped her penguins. She came right over to me, and she opened up her mouth. And she engulfed the front of the camera. Her canines were on top of my head, two were below my chin. You know, I'm basically staring down her throat.
And I can't believe you managed to take a picture of this, because I'm looking at this picture, and these teeth are huge.
The canines?
Yeah, they're like massive.
So you were doing business at this moment?
Yeah, I'm working at that point.
So you can even see the texture of the seal's tongues. Like, she has these little fibers on it.
Oh, it's 180-degree view. So yeah, to get that perspective, I'm basically in the mouth to get that shot.
Wow.
So then what happened?
And she backs off, looks at me, sniffed my flippers, touched them with her nose, poked me in the bum, came up, did this open mouth threat display again. And then she swims away. Oof. Wow. I was just getting ready to swim back to the Zodiac. You know, I've been in the water for quite a while and I'm cold. And all of a sudden she shows up with a freshly caught live penguin chick in her mouth.
Huh.
And I'm sitting there staring at her, and she stops about 10 feet away from me. And she's got the penguin by the feet, and the penguin's flapping its flippers trying to get away. She lines the penguin up to face perfectly in my direction, and she lets it go. The penguin swam right by me, and she chases off after it and grabs it, comes back and does this again and again and again.
Why?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, what was she doing?
At first, I couldn't figure out what was going on. I thought maybe she was having a hard time eating it. And then it dawned on me she was trying to feed me.
Wait, did you make any attempt during this period to say, no, thank you?
No. No, I'm so in such disbelief at this point, I'm just trying to capture it.
Well, didn't you feel compelled as a social human to just offer some kind of gestural explanation? I mean, if it were me, I would have made some look like, come, I don't eat that stuff. Or
maybe it's like you take the penguin at that point. You're like, well, I mean, I couldn't touch the
penguin swimming 15 miles an hour, you know?
Oh, so you mean when she lets go, it just goes, phew!
Like a bullet.
No, he's pathetic is what he's saying. He's, I'm a pathetic creature. I can't actually catch the
I'm penguin. Thinking exposures, get the shot, keep shooting.
You're such a photo dude, you know?
Well, I work for National Geographic. I don't want to anthropomorphize too much, but as the penguin was swimming by, this huge seal, she looked over at me, and I swear she had a look of disgust in her face. So she goes off and gets another penguin. And this penguin now is quite weak and tired looking, so I think she's worn it down. She lets the penguin go. Penguin takes off. She grabs it, does that a couple more times.
And you're still not eating the penguin.
Right. Next encounter was bringing me dead penguins. And sometimes she would just drop off a dead penguin right on top of the camera, and she would just sit there with this dejected look on her face, staring at me. And then she went to the stage of flipping dead penguins on top of my head and trying to force feed me these penguins, telling me at this point, you know, eat these damn penguins. I'm trying to feed you. Why won't you eat my penguins? Eat the penguins. Then she would start to eat the penguins right in front of me and show me how to eat them. She would rip them apart on the surface, get the skin off them, and she's shredding them in the water in front of me.
And how much time is passing here? I mean, are we talking minutes, hours?
This went on for 4 days.
Four days. And when you're in the water, you know, day after day, what's happening for you at this point? Are you still just a guy with a camera, or?
I mean, I was starting to fall in love with this seal. It's just this animal that's just so intelligent and so powerful, and it could kill you in an instant. Yet you're, I mean.
But when you say you were in love, were you in love with the idea of this, or did you really like her?
I really liked her. She was beautiful. She was big. She had this beautiful face, beautiful silver color to her. She kind of glowed underwater. I'm just so in love with this seal at this point. I'm not sleeping at night. I have a hard time eating. I just can't wait to see her. I can't. The first thing in the morning, you know, first sign of light, I'm in that zodiac. And then on the fourth day is when, you know, I was thinking, okay, maybe she's weary of me and she's getting tired of me, so I'm just going to totally leave her alone. And that's when I started going off and presenting myself to other seals who were swimming around the rookery. And I was in the water, and the same big female came up to me, and she started to do all these really beautiful ballet-like moves. I'm photographing her and looking at her, and all of a sudden she drops her penguin. She turns upside down, and she does this big guttural, cook, 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 this big jarring noise. It's vibrating my whole body. I can really feel it in my chest. It's so loud. And I'm thinking, am I being attacked? She finally told me that she's sick of me and wants me off her feeding grounds. But as soon as she did that, another leopard seal shot out from right behind me. And so this leopard seal had snuck in behind me. And she did that noise to chase that seal away, a smaller seal. She chased the seal away. It too had a penguin. She grabbed its penguin and brought me that seal's penguin and dropped it off in front of me.
Wow.
Wow. You are a lucky guy.
Wow. Yeah,
I mean, I'm almost getting emotional reliving that. I mean, it's very powerful.
Have you ever been in love with an animal in quite this way before?
Never, never.
Have you ever had an experience with another human that rivals this?
Perhaps when I was a kid with my mom, someone taking care of you and feeling safe and nurtured and protected, but I've never had that in my life as an adult.
This is such an interesting species moment here.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're doing something.
You're transgressing or something.
It sounds like you're stealing something from the gods right here, right at this moment.
I mean, I don't know what words I can find to explain it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.